the French. Chapter 13. Progress at Montbellard. The attention which Farrell bestowed on France did not divert his attention from the place where he was residing. Arriving at Montbellard about the end of July 1524, he had hardly sown the seed, before the first fruits of the harvest, to use the words of Ecolampadius, began to appear. Farrell wrote to his friend with great exultation. "It is an easy thing," replied the doctor of Baal, "to instill a few dogmas into the ears of our auditors, but to change their hearts is in the power of God alone." The Chevalier de Cocht, delighted with this intelligence, ran with his usual vivacity to Peter Toussaint. "I shall set off tomorrow to visit Farrell," said he hastily. Toussaint, more calm, was writing to the evangelist of Montbellard. "Be careful," said he to Farrell. "You are engaged in an important cause. It must not be polluted by the counsels of men. The mighty ones promise you their favor, their support, and heaps of gold. But to put your trust in these things is deserting Christ and walking in darkness." Toussaint was finishing this letter when the Chevalier entered. The latter took it and departed for Montbellard. He found the city in great commotion. Many of the nobles were alarmed, and said as they looked contemptuously at Farrell, "What does this sorry fellow want with us? Would to God he had never come! He cannot stay here, for he will ruin us all, as well as himself." The lords who had taken refuge with the Duke at Montbellard feared that the disturbance, which everywhere accompanied the Reformation, would attract the attention of Ferdinand and Charles V, and that they would be expelled from their last asylum. But it was the clergy in particular who resisted Farrell. The superior of the Franciscans of Besancon had hastened to Montbellard, and formed a plan of defense in conjunction with the clergy of the place. On the following Sunday, Farrell had hardly begun to preach, before they interrupted him, calling him liar and heretic. In an instant the whole assembly was in an uproar. The audience rose up, and called for silence. The Duke hurried to the spot, seized both Farrell and the superior, and ordered the latter either to prove or to retract his charges. The Franciscan adopted the last alternative, and an official account of the whole affair was published. This attack excited Farrell all the more. He thought it was now his duty to unmask without scruple those interested priests, and drawing the sword of the word, he plied it vigorously. He was more inclined to imitate Jesus when he expelled the money changers from the temple and overthrew their tables, than when the spirit of prophecy declared of him, "He shall neither strive nor cry, neither shall any man hear his voice in the streets." Ecolampadius was affrighted. These two men were perfect types of two characters diametrically opposed to each other, and yet both worthy of admiration. "You were sent," wrote Ecolampadius to Farrell, "to draw men gently to the truth, and not to drag them with violence, to spread the gospel, and not to curse them. Physicians resort to amputation only when other means have failed. Act the part of a physician, and not of an executioner. It is not enough, in my opinion, to be gentle towards the friends of the gospel. You must likewise gain over the adversaries. If the wolves are driven from the sheepfold, let the sheep at least hear the voice of the shepherd. Pour oil and wine into the wounds, and conduct yourself as an evangelist, not as a judge or a tyrant." The report of these labors spread into France and Lorraine, and the Sorbonne and the Cardinal Guise were beginning to be alarmed at this meeting of refugees at Baal and Montbellard. They would willingly have broken up a troublesome alliance, for error knows no greater triumph than when attracting some deserter to its standard. Already had Marshal Mazurier and others given the papal party in France an opportunity of rejoicing over shameful defections, but if they could succeed in seducing one of these confessors of Christ, who had taken refuge on the banks of the Rhine, and who had suffered so much for the name of the Lord, how great would be the victory for the Roman hierarchy. They therefore planted their batteries, and the youngest of these refugees was the object of their attack. The Dean, the Cardinal of Lorraine, and all those who joined the crowded meetings held in this prelate's mansion deplored the sad fate of Peter Toussaint, who had once promised so fair. "He is at Baal," said they, "in the house of Ecolampadius, living with one of the leaders of this heresy." They wrote to him with fervor, and as if they would rescue him from eternal condemnation. These letters were the more painful to the young man, because he could not help recognizing in them the marks of sincere affection. One of his relations, probably the dean himself, urged him to remove to Paris, to Metz, or to any other place in the world, provided it were far away from these Lutherans. This relation, bearing in mind all that Toussaint owed to him, doubted not that he would immediately comply, but when he found his efforts useless, his affection changed into violent hatred. At the same time, this resistance exasperated the whole family and all his friends against the young refugee. They went to his mother, who was under the power of the monks. The priests crowded round her, frightening and persuading her that her son had committed crimes that they could not mention without shuddering. Upon this, the afflicted mother wrote a touching letter to her son, full of weeping, said he, and in which she described her misery in heartrending language. "Oh, wretched mother," said she. "Oh, unnatural son, cursed be the breast that suckled thee, and the knees that bare thee." The unhappy Toussaint was distracted. What should he do? He could not return into France. By leaving Baal and going to Zurich or Wittenberg, beyond the reach of his family, he would only add to their sorrow. Ecolampadius advised a middle course. "Leave my house," said he. With a heart full of sadness, he adopted the suggestion and went to live with an ignorant and obscure priest, one well adapted to reassure his relations. What a change for Toussaint! He never met his host save at meals, at which times they were continually discussing matters of faith, and as soon as the repast was over, Toussaint retired to his chamber, where alone, far from noise and controversy, he carefully studied the Word of God. "The Lord is my witness," said he, "that in this valley of tears I have but one desire, that of seeing Christ's kingdom extended, so that all with one mouth may glorify God." One circumstance occurred which consoled Toussaint. The enemies of the gospel were daily growing stronger in Metz. At his entreaty, the Chevalier d'Esch departed in the mouth of January 1525 to encourage the evangelical Christians in this city. He traversed the forests of the Vosges and reached the place where Leclerc had laid down his life, carrying with him several books with which Farel had provided him. It was not only to Lorraine that these Frenchmen turned their eyes. The Chevalier de Cocht received letters from one of Farel's brothers, depicting the state of Dauphiné in the gloomiest colors. He carefully avoided showing them lest he should alarm the weak-hearted, and was content with ardently seeking from God the support of his almighty hands. In December 1524, Peter Verrier, a Dauphiné's messenger, arrived on horseback at Montbéliard with commissions for Anemond and Farel. The Chevalier, with his usual vivacity, immediately resolved on returning to France. "If Peter has brought any money," wrote he to Farel, "keep it. If he has brought any letters, open and copy them, and then forward them to me. Do not, however, sell the horse, but take care of it, for perchance I may need it. I am inclined to enter France secretly, and go to Jacobus Faber, Lefebvre, and Arandius. Write and tell me what you think of it." Such was the confidence and open-heartedness that existed between these refugees. The one opened the other's letters, and received his money. It is true that de Cocht was already indebted 36 crowns to Farel, whose purse was always open to his friends. There was more zeal than discretion in the Chevalier's desire to re-enter France. He was of too imprudent a character not to expose himself to certain death. This Farel no doubt explained to him. He left Baal, and withdrew to a small town, where he had great hopes of acquiring the German language, God willing. Farel continued preaching the gospel in Montbéliard. His soul was vexed as he beheld the majority of the people in this city entirely given up to the worship of images. It was, in his opinion, a revival of the old pagan idolatry. Yet the exhortations of Ecolampadius, and the fear of compromising the truth, would perhaps have long restrained him, but for an unforeseen circumstance. One day about the end of February, it was the feast of Saint Anthony, Farel was walking on the banks of a little river that runs through the city, beneath a lofty rock on which the citadel is built, when, on reaching the bridge, he met a procession, which was crossing it, reciting prayers to Saint Anthony, and headed by two priests bearing the image of this saint. Farel suddenly found himself face to face with these superstitions, without, however, having sought for them. A violent struggle took place in his soul. Shall he give way? Shall he hide himself? Would not this be a cowardly act of unbelief? These lifeless images, borne on the shoulders of ignorant priests, made his blood boil. Farel boldly advanced, snatched the shrine of the holy hermit from the priest's arms, and threw it over the bridge into the river. And then, turning to the awe-stricken crowd, he exclaimed, "Poor idolaters, will ye never forsake your idolatry?" The priests and people stood motionless with astonishment. A religious fear seemed to rivet them to the spot. But they soon recovered from their stupor. "The image is drowning," exclaimed one of the crowd, and transports and shouts of rage succeeded their death-like silence. The multitude would have rushed on the sacrilegious wretch who had just thrown the object of their adoration into the water. But Pharaoh, we know not how, escaped their violence. There is a reason, we are aware, to regret that the reformer should have been hurried into the commission of an act that tended rather to check the progress of the truth. No one should think himself authorized to attack with violence any institution sanctioned by the public authority. There is, however, in the zeal of the reformer something more noble than that cold prudence so common among men, which shrinks before the least danger, and fears to make the least sacrifice for the advancement of God's kingdom. Pharaoh was not ignorant that by this proceeding he was exposing himself to the fate of Leclerc. But his own conscience bore witness that he desired only to promote the glory of God, and this made him superior to all fear. After this affair of the bridge, which is a characteristic feature in Pharaoh's history, the reformer was obliged to hide himself, and he quitted the town soon after. He took refuge at Baal with Ecolampadius, but ever preserved that attachment for Montbéliard which a servant of God never ceases to entertain for the first fruits of his ministry. Sad tidings awaited Pharaoh at Baal. If he was a fugitive, his friend Enemon de Cocht was seriously ill. Pharaoh immediately sent him 4 gold crowns, but a letter written by Oswald Myconius on the 25th of March announced the death of the Chevalier. "Let us so live," said Oswald, "that we may enter into that rest into which we hope the soul of Enemon has already entered." Thus did Enemon descend to a premature grave, still young, full of activity and strength, willing to undertake every labor to evangelize France, and who was in himself a host. God's ways are not our ways. Not long before, and in the neighborhood of Zurich, another Chevalier, Ulrich Hutten, had breathed his last. There is some similarity in the characters of the German and French knights, but the piety and Christian virtues of the Dauphinese place him far above the witty and intrepid enemy of the Pope and of the monks. Shortly after Enemon's death, Pharaoh, unable to remain in Baal, whence he had been once banished, joined his friends Capito and Busa at Strasbourg. Strasbourg, an imperial city, at whose head was Sturm, one of the most distinguished men in Germany, and which contained many celebrated doctors within its walls, was as it were an advanced post of the Reformation, thrown beyond the Rhine, and in which the persecuted Christians of France and Lorraine took refuge, and from whence they hoped to win these countries to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Lambert's pious ambition was to become for France what Luther was for Germany, and accordingly he had no sooner reached Strasbourg after quitting Metz, than he made his preparations, waiting for the moment when he should be enabled to carry the sword of the gospel into the very heart of that country which he loved so tenderly. He first appealed to Francis I. "The Pope," said he, "if he had his way, would change every king into a beggar. Lend your ear to the truth, most excellent prince, and God will make you great among the princes of the earth. Woe be to all the nations whose master is the Pope. O Avignon, city of my birth, art thou not the wretched daughter of Babylon? Given over to a legate, not of holiness, but of impiety and heresy, thou sayest lewd sports, immodest dances, and adultery multiply within thy walls, and all around thy fields are laid waste by daily hunting parties, and thy poor laborers oppressed. O most Christian king, thy people thirst for the word of God." At the same time addressing the Pope, he said, "Ere long that powerful France which thou art wont to call thy arm will separate from thee." Such were Lambert's illusions. Finding that his epistle had produced no effect, he wrote a second in a still more earnest tone. "What?" said he. "The Arabians, Chaldeans, Greeks, and Jews possess the word of God in their own language, and the French, Germans, Italians, and Spaniards cannot have it in theirs. Let God but speak to the nations in the language of the people, and the empire of pride will crumble into dust." These anticipations were not realized. At Montbéliard and Baal, as at Lyons, the ranks of the reformers had suffered. Some of the most devoted combatants had been taken off by death, others by persecution and exile. In vain did the warriors of the gospel mount everywhere to the assault. Everywhere they were beaten back. But if the forces they had concentrated, first at Meaux, then at Lyons, and afterwards at Baal, were dispersed in succession, there still remained combatants here and there, who in Lorraine, at Meaux, and even in Paris, struggled more or less openly to uphold the word of God in France. Though the Reformation saw its columns broken, it still had its isolated champions. Against these the Sorbonne and the Parliament were about to turn their anger. They would not have remaining on the soil of France a single one of these noble-minded men who had undertaken to plant in it the standard of Jesus Christ. An unheard-of misfortune seemed now to be conspiring with the enemies of the Reformation, and to aid them in the accomplishment of their task.